Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with this week's episode of Politico's Off Message podcast. And before I get to the business of the week, I got one of the best emails ever, and I want to share it with you. This is from Shelley from California. I'm not going to give her last name. And the subject line of the email is, "Stop the cursing!" Exclamation point. Here it goes. "Dear Glenn, okay, so you can curse on your podcast. Big deal. As a former social studies teacher, I would have loved to play some of your interviews in the classroom. So quit cursing and give the high school kids a chance. Also, if you want an interview suggestion, how about me? I am a doctor of education, in my 60s, and know a thing or two about politics. Oh, yeah, and I'm a woman. Oh, yeah, I'm from California. So get out of your bubble and interview real Americans and stop the cursing." And she is a doctor. She signed it as a doctor. What I will do, and I'm going to send her an email to this effect, is we are going to produce, depending on the podcast that she chooses, she's going to email me and tell me which one she wants, and I'm going to have my very diligent and hardworking producer, Bridget, bleep out all the curse words so that if she wants to use it for her own listening or to play it for her for her former students or send it anywhere she wants, it will be a G-rated version of our goddamn podcast. So this week is kind of a special podcast. Jake Sherman and Anna Palmer, actually, I believe the appropriate order is Anna Palmer and Jake Sherman, are taking over for Mike Allen, putting together our playbook. It's a big change for us. And I thought it'd be a good idea to have both of these guys on to just talk with them about what their plans are, and also to get, you know, for those of you that don't know them, I do, to get to know them. They're both very interesting people. And the conversation is interesting. I didn't want this to be what we in newspapers call a house ad, where you're kind of just doing the normal self-promotional crap, talking about how great everything is going to be. Mike Allen's shoes are enormous shoes to fill, and the changes that Jake and Ann are going to make are significant changes. So, you know, everything that you try that's new entails a lot of risk, but these are really two of the best people we've got. And their stories, particularly Anna's story about being a young woman a decade ago coming up on the Hill and having to deal with kind of the baked-in sexual harassment and sexism of being a reporter in this town, it was totally fascinating. And I think that's one of the interesting characteristics of the new playbook is, you know, Anna's coming at it from that perspective. And that's something new. I don't think there's a tip sheet out there now. Any of the kind of the morning product stuff that has a woman as one of its main producers. So that's a new element in that. Anyway, it's a conversation well worth listening to. Let's do our usual business. Please follow us and rate us on iTunes. We are doing pretty well on that. I am told one of my colleagues said that when I say we're doing pretty well on that, I sound a lot like Donald Trump. Well, it's huge that we're getting all that feedback. And send letters like Shelley's letter. I love these things. I'm getting a lot of them. They're really make my day, both the positive feedback and the negative feedback. And the guest suggestions are really helpful. There's a half dozen people now we're chasing that we wouldn't have otherwise chased. And the other thing I just kind of want to preview is we're going to be doing a lot of really interesting, fun, different stuff at the conventions that I will update you guys on as time goes by. With no further ado, here are the new playbookers, Anna Palmer and Jake Sherman. Let's talk a little bit about your experience personally in coming to D.C. Tell the folks where you're from originally, and how did you get here?
Well, I have a kind of unique story. I'm originally from North Dakota. I grew up on a farm where the motto of the town, Kindred, is where kindness is a way of life, which is kind of funny.
is that your motto now?
I'm not quite sure I've kept that with
Actually,
me.
Actually, here it's a little different. It's kindness is a way of death.
Yeah. It's a little town of 600, right. And, you know, graduated with 47 people. But I was a Senate page in high school, so it was kind of my first
intro. For who?
For then-Senator Kent Conrad.
Wow.
I wrote the essay. My parents are not donors. Very important caveat, I think, because it was actually a great introduction to Washington.
Wait, hold on. What was the essay?
Now that was reaching far back. I think I was like 15 years old.
Okay.
But
you're only 18 now.
Yeah,
so
right? Exactly. It was a great introduction to Washington because it made me realize I never wanted to be a staffer. You would sit on the House or the Senate floor and you had to remember what senators wanted, what kind of water, with ice cubes, no ice cubes. You were handing out pamphlets, bringing bills, and I was the only one who was seeing these massive speeches. There was nobody else paying attention. Maybe an unsophisticated view of Washington, but it was just the kind of the slowness and the slow moving, you know, as a body was very clear to me.
By the way, I was a New York State Senate intern. And I remembered I was given a tutorial very quickly. My first day on the floor, the member who I was working with summoned me over and I walked augustly towards his chair and he leaned into my ear and he whispered, "Split pea soup, please, and don't forget the croutons."
Was it Anthony Weiner?
No, it was Leonard Price Stavisky, the head of the Higher Education Committee. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No. So it's a long story. So anyway, so that is, I did that.
What initially attracted you to Washington? Why were you into this?
My parents were always interested in politics. We watched the news every night. I think I wanted to be a reporter since I was in second grade. I just really was I like to ask questions. I wasn't really afraid of people. So I left. I went to St. Olaf College in Minnesota, small liberal arts college, and I really wanted to go to journalism school, but my parents really wanted me to go to a liberal arts school, be well grounded. So every summer I interned. So I was, you know, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, at a TV station, the CBS affiliate. This is a great fun fact of Anna Palmer trivia. I once rode a horse on local television. I mean, I would do anything, you know, like if you put me on air, I was kind of fearless. So for the Cheyenne Frontier Days, the largest outdoor rodeo in the world.
I'm aware of that.
So I did that. I worked it. So I thought I wanted to do TV. I came to Washington for a semester, interned, stayed, and then
lived behind Politico.
I did.
Another piece of Anna Palmer trivia.
I know. Everyone's really learning a lot here.
Before there was Politico.
Jake is also grew up on a farm.
Yeah, a farm in Stamford, Connecticut.
It's real rural.
It's a farm full of people who worked at Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns when it existed.
Are you kidding me? Actually, no. Goldman Sachs.
Well, actually,
can we have the transcripts?
I don't have them. I do believe the Sachs family did live in Stamford, though.
Are you kidding me?
I am not.
Who is the richest person that you knew growing up?
Goodness, I don't know. I mean, Stephen A. Cohen, the hedge fund manager, is his fund is based in Stamford. Who's the richest person I knew growing up? I knew a small fry real estate guy, Donald Trump. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. I didn't ask people for their net worth.
But it really was a lot of...
My parents said, whenever I ask someone questions in my family about money, my parents would be like, I don't know. I haven't seen his bank statement.
But they were local celebrities, right?
My parents?
No, not your parents.
Oh, no. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot richer people in Greenwich than Stamford, which is the bordering town. So,
What is the most plutocratic... memory of your childhood?
I didn't grow up with butlers and stuff. I mean, yes, I did grow up in Stamford in a strong Jewish community, a good day school, many synagogues. My parents wanted me to grow up in Jewish environs.
Well, you're
like they did.
Well, you're in Washington, so you're in good company. What do your folks do?
My mom's a nursery school teacher, and my dad works for an asset management firm.
Okay, what does that actually mean?
He invests. He spent most of his career investing as like a marketer. He went around and raised money for a firm, and he raised a lot of institutional money, so universities and pensions, and he had the New York City Firefighters for a long time.
Their retirement fund.
Yeah.
Wow.
I have to imagine, I don't talk with my father about business, but I have to imagine things like that don't really exist anymore because pensions and retirement funds, except for big municipalities, are a lot harder to find these days.
I actually had a cousin who did the same thing, and he lived in Long Island, and he did the California Teachers Retirement System. It's a big, big, big
Huge.
Deal. Where are they from originally?
My mom's from Montreal.
You know, I didn't know that.
Yep. Grew up until 13 in Montreal.
In the Jewish?
He has dual citizenship.
Yeah, I do.
Didn't know that.
In Côte Saint-Luc.
So you can get out quickly.
I can get out quickly. If need be, I could.
The rest of us are just going to be at your coattails.
What's the name of that the Duddy Kravitz deli, the one I have, Schwartz's? The one up there.
You know,
it's known for the smoked meats.
Schwartz's sounds right, but the great delicacy of Montreal is Montreal bagels.
I've had them.
Which are small hard ones, and, yeah, ones. Smaller. And my dad's from Connecticut. He grew up in, he was born in New York, but grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut.
So how did your mom wind up in Canada, her family?
You know, some Jews came from Poland to New York, some came to Canada. I guess it depended which way the winds were blowing.
It was easier to get into Canada.
I have to imagine it was probably easier, yeah. My great-grandmother, who just only recently died, came from Poland to Montreal in her teens.
Really?
I think. And
between the wars?
I don't know exactly when, yeah. But I still have family there, and I still go there. It's cold as hell in the winter.
No, I really
nice
like
in the spring.
I love Toronto, by the way. I got to be the only person that really digs Toronto.
Yeah, I'm not a big Toronto fan.
Now, Sherman is short for what?
Nothing. I don't think anything. I think we've been off the boat for so long that it's just...
What are the other... Okay, give me some of the other family names.
My mother's maiden name is Lecker. We don't have any good ones.
Those aren't
ones.
Good.
What's your original name?
Oh, my original name. My middle name
like
is...
Like Thrushkovsky or
no,
something?
No, Thrush is Scots-Irish English. It's the quarter my grandfather, Jack Thrush. There are Thrushes who died in the Revolutionary War. The other family names are Wiesenfeld, Schoenfeld, and Klaus.
You should go by those names. That should be, if you ever write a book,
your
that should
alias.
Be your pen name.
Totally.
But my middle name is Hyman, and I was named after my great-grandfather, Hyman Klaus, who, family lore has it, rode a white horse to escape the Tsar's army to Rotterdam. It's
who
complete
are
bullshit.
Most, who are the most notable Jews in Washington, D.C.?
Are you kidding me?
Give me some names.
Well, you go on the Supreme Court, right?
Well, yeah, but those are... Well-known Jews.
Who's you have to,
are
you
there
have
any
to,
secret Jews in Washington?
You're outing Jews now? Okay, this is good, guys.
Senator Bennett is a crypto Jew. By the way, this we're doing this for all you Stormfront listeners out there. Oh, Senator Bennett.
Who's the best known this. Jew? Henry Waxman?
The best known Jew? No. Could you stop?
That's just in your world.
Yeah. Chuck Schumer.
Chuck Schumer, that's true.
Chuck Schumer is King Jew and also, by the way, a man
who's Prince Jew.
Who's Prince Jew? Philippe. Because because they, I believe, both have their own tables at Chinese restaurants.
Chinese restaurant on the hill that Steve Israel likes is terrible.
It is. Well, that's Chuck's Chinese restaurant, too. So you covered the hill. We overlapped a little bit. And we overlapped very briefly because the minute I saw you up there, I had to get the hell out. I think I've told this story before, running into you at a press conference when you were just working for us at a GW. It was a Nancy Pelosi press conference. I was sitting there, and I was actually blogging. I was just typing it out. And you're like, can I use that? And I'm like, you know what? I think my expiration date is up. we'll let this terrier dig his teeth into these people for a while. But what really happened at that point was it flipped and it became Republican.
And all your sources were gone.
All my sources were gone. And we hired the
Thrush exit.
But we did wind up hiring the one that stayed, Brad Dayspring.
It all comes full circle.
So what's it like? Okay, so you were a kid coming up. Obviously, you went to GW and you were involved in journalism. Did you study journalism in school?
Yeah, and I also went to grad school at Columbia where
I
was a student of your good friend Wayne.
Wayne Barrett. A lot of people don't know Wayne. Wayne is, I believe, one of the greatest living reporters in the country. Great Village Voice reporter. Wrote the definitive book on Donald Trump.
And the definitive book on Rudy Giuliani.
Found out that
City for Sale.
City for Sale is the one on Koch.
Koch, sorry.
Which is the book that got me into the business, if you got to know. But the Giuliani book is Wayne Barrett found out that Rudy Giuliani's dad was, in fact, a small-time felon, which really blew Rudy's head up, as if he needed it. But what was it like coming up? You were very confident. Coming up on the Hill. What was it like sort of cracking that code in terms of figuring out what House leadership was up to?
Jim Vandehei gave me good advice. Jim Vandehei, our former boss right. and the founder of Politico, not Jewish, right. for the record.
Definitively.
Definitively not Jewish.
That's good.
He just said that every meeting that goes on, you should find one person who could tell you what is happening on the inside. And I think that's good advice. And I think a lot of people want to pass judgment on what people are doing on Capitol Hill or what people are doing on campaigns. Like, this is a good idea. This is a bad idea.
What do you mean by that? Like,
I think reporters tend to fall into these traps, and we've talked about this in Playbook. Like, we might think one day that the Clinton campaign or the Trump campaign, is doing something horribly stupid.
Just
strategically.
Monday morning quarterback kind of stuff.
No, like while it's happening, being like, this is a really bad idea or whatever.
Right.
We both approach it as just let them lay out their case, explain what they're doing, and let other people decide, which is really simple. But you'd be surprised how many times you do that, and it's a great story, and people really appreciate it instead of passing judgment on
hey, let's fight this out. I have completely the opposite approach. I will walk up to somebody and say, I think we both.
You're a commie, so I mean, first of all, let's just start with that as your baseline.
For our readers, Glenn is sitting here in a Cuba hat. So
wearing a red wristwatch.
A red Cuba hat.
Because it's almost time for the revolution. I've covered tons of Republicans and I have good Republican sources. I mean, the thing about it is, the way that I tend to do it is I'm watching this thing and I have a thesis and I bang it off of people and I have conversations with people and they tell me, no, you're wrong. I think the key, they're actually the same sort of process, because in my case, I have people explaining to me why I got my thesis wrong or why it's right. So I tend to think like having an idea, starting off with an idea or a thesis, tends to be a way to kind of roll the process in the direction as well.
I don't know though. I mean, I think from our perspective on the Hill, you're talking about what's happening every single day and you're putting together little nuggets that then create the overarching argument or the storyline.
Right.
But it's less about you're doing this because your motives are bad or your motives are good or this is your outcome you're seeking. It's much more about kind of putting all of the puzzle pieces together, I would say.
So it's getting the puzzle pieces together so you can put them together, so you can ultimately have either your readers or other people. That is funny. It is antithetical. It's why I love what you guys are doing, but it's why I could never do it, as if I need to be told that.
But on the other hand, if you do have a strong thesis, right, and you're going to go after it and you're going to say, you know, Eric Cantor is screwing up, Give Eric Cantor or Brad Dayspring in this context the ability to get his voice heard in the story.
See, that I'm not, right. I'm totally not disputing that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, to me, the worst kind of reporting, we can both agree on this, are reporters who go in with a thesis, find evidence to the contrary, and still proceed with a stupid thesis anyway. A lot of people.
Malpractice.
And a lot of people do that shit. And the other, and obviously a corollary of that is not going to all the parties and running things by them. I think that's a common factor. But I want to hit you with the Wayne Barrett argument. Wayne Barrett, his investigative approach, I haven't worked with Wayne on stories, but we've collaborated in various ways. If you've ever done any investigative work in New York City and you're covering housing or City Hall, you wind up coming across Wayne. It's a very collaborative kind of little co-op. And Wayne's whole thing is he starts off with an idea that this son of a bitch is corrupt. I mean, really, when you think about it, he thinks Ramon Velez, the great slumlord of, not the slumlord, the great poverty pimp of the South Bronx, who Barrett fought for years, his thesis was, this guy's a crook. I don't know how he's a crook, but I'm going to spend 2 years figuring out that he's a crook.
Yeah, but I don't think that's actually different kind of in theory from what Anna and I talk about, because usually we have a tip, and I'm sure Wayne has a tip or a hunch in some way too. But I actually, when someone tells me something and says, Congressman X is doing Y,
right,
I'm like, okay, this has to be true, and I try to talk myself out of it in my reporting, because we've been through too many situations together where we've doubted that something was going on, we've looked into it, and then it's going on exactly as people told us. So now our theory is, it's happening, you have to prove us wrong.
so essentially you've made the bar higher so that your reporting is entirely defensible. Let's talk about the Iron Shock stories, which you guys did together with Bresnahan, John Bresnahan, our great Capitol Hill bureau chief. How do you, just without giving it away, I mean, how do you kind of get on to that kind of thing? For people who don't know how this process works, without again revealing methods and sources here, how does that kind of thing happen?
You kind of could reveal the methods and sources if you'd like.
I mean, I think what happened was Washington Post did a story, and it was a feature story on Aaron Schock, and it was supposed to be something else, but they went in and they saw that his office was literally decorated like Downton Abbey, which was very unusual.
This was Ben Terrace's famous story.
But
yeah,
which is pretty stunning, is that nobody, no editor caught that this would clearly look like an ethics violation or a violation or a misuse of government funding. And so this story kind of goes out there. It gets a little bit of a pop, and I was kind of obsessed with it. And
because you love Downton Abbey.
She's a big mid-century.
I'm big against the whole honor code on Capitol Hill. Jay has heard it. Say it 1,000 times, but you know that that members can just kind of say and put their expenses in and not have any proof for what they're doing. And so we, the three of us, spent a Saturday, I think a weekend, going through, I mean, very unsexy financial disclosure reports.
Yeah. And we kind of kept coming, we published an initial story, which described how Aaron was spending all this money and time and resources in Palm Beach, Miami Beach, Aspen, L.A., at all these crazy hotels.
And how'd you get that? From clips or from...
No, just from financial...
Not even former staffers or people
no,
in other...
No, we had some sources.
We
but,
were talking yeah. to people.
But he was also not shy about it. He posted stuff on social media, too.
Stories like this hold up when you have actual facts, right? So, like, just because a former staffer says, oh, my boss does all this crazy stuff, people say that all the time.
And
right.
a lot of it's true, but you can't prove it.
You can't prove it. Proving it is the bar that we try to do.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, you know, we had all of the financial FEC disclosures and we're, you know, kind of cross-tabulating them. And one of the things we found very quickly was he was very sloppy.
Yeah, he disclosed a flight. He said he bought a piece of software from this company. The name I'm not recalling.
I remember when you guys were doing
and
this.
And we called up, we looked up the company and it said they did software for Wall Street or something like that. So I called up the CEO of the company. I said, did Aaron Schock ever buy software? He said, no, but I gave him a ride on my plane and he paid for it.
Wow.
So he misreported it. And then.
And that was really.
More, I mean, you just keep going, right, as you dig further. We also, I mean, as you know, these kinds of stories start kind of, there's a snowball effect because right. I got a crazy document dump of like thousands of pages of, you know, what he'd been doing and his itineraries and
his
all
calendar.
This stuff. Yeah, his calendar.
And how did you, like, what did it just appear somewhere?
Yeah, sometimes you get lucky.
And then the other interesting thing that happened is I had flown out to Peoria. He was doing an event out there. And I said to my editor, Mike Zappler, I said, hey, I want to go to this event. He's like, are we going to get an interview with him? I was like, I don't know, man, but we have a better chance if we're there than we do if we're sitting in the Capitol.
Absolutely.
So I got him and he delivered his, well, we famous. It's famous for us now. Yeah. I said, did you break any laws? He said, I sure hope not. So then he had this car.
And you did not. We should say that you did not run into him at the Peoria Mensa meeting.
No, this was at an event speech.
For him.
And then the crazy thing was he had this car, the Chevy Suburban, which was way really super nice, souped up, had, you know, nice wheels, tinted windows and everything. And I thought he had bought the car with campaign resources
right.
or with government resources and put it in his name. So I put in a Freedom of Information request with the Secretary of State of Illinois to get the deed records. But I always go very, very broad on my request. And I said, I wanted any vehicle records for Aaron Schock ever. So I got back to his like high school Jeep Wrangler or Cherokee or whatever.
Wow.
But at that point, he had sold this car. He had it for about a year and he put like 60,000 miles on it. But then we went back over government spending records and he had expensed 160,000 miles on a car that only had 60,000 miles on it. So we called him up and we called up his outside communications advisor at that point and we asked him. He put us off for a little bit and then like within hours he said he's resigning.
Okay, so here's a question. You're going from this to playbook. Mm-hmm. Is there a little bit...
Yes.
I'm a pain in the ass on this. But is it a little bit, are you going to miss this kind of stuff? How are you going to break, could you possibly devote the same amount of energy? It sounds like I was around you guys at the time. It was the time of your lives. I mean, you're really, not the time of your lives, so you're really enjoying yourself. Are you going to, don't give me a stock answer on this. Are you going to miss that a little bit? The fact that you can kind of
I don't think we're going to stop it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think like our obsession, right, with public records and what's happening behind the scene doesn't stop because we write a daily newsletter. I think clearly we like to break news, right? If there's anything that I think Jake and I are probably both well known for is breaking news.
Right.
I think Playbook is a great venue for that, one. And two, I would say we have designs on doing like deeper reported stories. There's a team now that's going to do it. You know, I don't think it'll be every week that we're writing these kinds of stories, but I think we plan on spending a lot of time doing kind of behind the scenes how Washington works stories.
And also the other thing that you're going to see a lot in Playbook is when you boil it down, I think the best model for Playbook is when you go, Daniel brought back his Berkshire Eagle, which is the local newspaper up in the Berkshires.
By the way, Alec McGillis, the great reporter, started.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
So
his dad was an editor there.
If you look at Playbook, it really is just a village newspaper, and that's what it is at its best. And so I think you're going to see in our Playbook a lot of public records.
Wait
flashes.
A second. I worked in local journalism. I worked for local newspapers, okay? started off in local journalism. It is very hard to do investigative reporting as a local reporter. You want to know why? Because Bob's, the hardware store you're writing about, isn't there the same issue with, isn't there the same issue in going really hard against biting the hand that feeds here?
Well, I think yes, but we also didn't shy away from it on Capitol Hill, which is basically a little village of its own, right? The Republicans didn't stop feeding us information because we went after Aaron Schock or we went after the relationship that Bill Schuster was having with the lobbyist who was lobbying him. So I think there is a way to thread the needle. Is it a delicate dance? Sure, but I think that's, you know, what we're going to do. I don't think it's just going to be some PR platform.
No. But Mikey did it. We're talking obviously about Mike Allen, who created this platform, made it a nationally recognized thing. Mikey has a different sort of style, more kind of encompassing. He's sort of everywhere all at once, you know. And that, you know, I'll tell you a story. I remember running into somebody. It was some random thing. I was at a dinner in West Virginia, Wheeling, West Virginia, a Democratic political dinner. And some old lady comes up to me and said, "My bus got stuck by the side of the road, and this nice young man came with an entire case of chilled water." And that was Mike Allen. Right? I mean,
did he arrive from Washington with the case?
I don't know what the hell it was. It was at some political event in West Virginia. I mean, the guy just sort of has you know, an omnipresence and a little bit of a mystery to him. Obviously, you guys aren't. That is not the road you're going to go down. How do you establish a rapport with an audience when you have a guy who had that kind of a relationship with people?
Yeah, I mean, Mike is the ultimate kind of friendly guy, right? Even when he kind of takes a shot, it's in a nice way, I think. And that's one of the things that he's really been able to cultivate in terms of the audience there, right? Because he does sometimes write things that are hard on, you know, the White House or The Hill or certain members. I mean, he definitely does, you know, kind of do that at times. I think for us, we really need to kind of focus on cultivating that community, cultivating the trust that he has built with them over the years. But I also think, you know, we're going to be us, right? If we try to be Mike, we fail.
Right.
And it, to me, it's like someone compared it to when Brett Favre left the Packers. Aaron Rodgers didn't try to be Brett Favre. He was Aaron Rodgers.
Right.
And that we don't want to try to be Mike. But
gee, I wonder who came up with that one.
It wasn't actually Vandehei.
But that would have been good.
I'll tell you who it was. I'm sure he won't care. Maybe he will, but it was Doug Thornell, who's a Democratic consultant who said, "Listen, you'd be crazy to try to be someone you're not."
If you look at the audience that is there, a lot of them were from the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. That was when Mikey was kind of coming up as a reporter. And so I think you have a whole other kind of generation of people that are running offices. I mean, for example, I would say Nikki Kristoff of Uber is running an office. You know, you have Kristen Soltis Anderson, who's like the pollster for millennials, right? There are contemporaries. And so in the way that, you know, we've reported on Washington for a long time, a lot of the people that are in his community will continue to want to be a part of Playbook. But we also bring just other sources, you know, from other parts of our lives.
And it's not like we're trying to say Playbook is going to become a read for people who are millennials, but these are people who are coming up and who are like really coming into power. The Brendan Buck of the world, who's Paul Ryan's chief of staff. There's just a million different people.
But look how these guys consume information as opposed to, I'm in Mikey's generation. So the notion of going through.
I always thought you were like 26 or 27.
That's I am. Thank you very much. It's the hair. But like I'm in Mikey's generation. So the idea of going through like a 2,000, 3,000 word, you know, even written in the dispatch style, you know, which is really kind of the old Walter Winchell style, right? Mm-hmm. The dispatch style takes quite a bit of doing, right? I mean, you really got to sit, you know, you got to pack a lunch or pack a breakfast and really go through that sucker, right? A lot of people who are younger really just consume stuff through social media. How are you guys planning on making an adjustment? Will you have Mike? You know, Mike has a lot of followers. Doesn't tend to tweet a ton,
right?
Do you feel? Are you going to sort of connect this to Twitter a little bit more? What's your social media strategy?
Yeah, I think connect it to Twitter. I also think Jake is a prolific tweeter, but I would also say more along the lines of Facebook too. Like, we want to go where our audience is. That's why we're talking about doing the radio or doing, you know, some kind of an audio thing where, you know, meet people where they already are. Don't make it harder for them to, you know, click on something.
And also the we're making Playbook also shareable from the newsletter. You're going to be able to share parts of Playbook in the newsletter. But we're going to bring the style that we already have. I mean, I do tweet a lot, and I will continue to tweet a lot. And that only helps to, I hope, in theory, if Twitter works the way we all think it does, it helps to fortify my brand and Anna's brand, and people brings people to Playbook. But people still do want a product in the morning that gives them exclusive scoops they can't get anywhere else, a 360-degree view of the landscape, and the community message board kind of aspect of Playbook. And I think our generation, and as Anna and I have talked about this and given this months of thought now, I think our generation kind of sees Playbook or has seen it as a impenetrable because they don't know Mike, right? Mike is kind of like, for people who don't know him, Mike does an unbelievable job at keeping and maintaining and building new sources, but he can't know the entire town, right? But people who don't know him, they're like, I'm not even going to try. You know, Mike is too famous. He's too...
It's an impenetrable castle.
Right.
He's
too famous. He's too big of a deal. He's on TV. He's all over the place. I mean, those people know us, and those are the kinds of people we're going to bring along and we're going to bring into the fold, we hope.
You know, when I first, it pissed me off when I was first covering the White House beat, when he'd sort of get the West Wing mind meld from two or three people I knew were giving it to him over in the, so you'd start off the day with what the idea that the White House had going forward or what an individual, I always found to me personally, as a reporter, that was the most useful kind of intel. Is that something, that seems to me like something you guys are going to be quite able to do as well, right?
And we've actually teed up a lot of the people in the big institutions around DC, New York, and LA to help kind of lay that out for us. And actually, these people are very eager and willing and excited to do that because I think it's not only useful for them, it's useful for their opponents and vice versa. Because
the kind of shadow boxing.
It's shadow boxing, right? It's the Trump campaign saying what they're trying to do to the extent that they're saying anything, right, and the Clinton campaign saying what they're trying to do. There are, and I've been keeping a running list of things that other reporters have missed in the last month in public documents, and we'll run it, a lot of them, the first week when we start Playbook. Some of the things that people miss that are so easily accessible that tell such great stories about people and personalities and power.
The dynamics of Washington.
Give me a vague, without getting into the specific thing, give me an example of the kind of thing. So this would be kind of light investigative?
About a month and a half ago, Harry Reid filed his personal financial disclosure document. And he disclosed, because he was required to, that his former chief of staff, David Crone, as a departing gift, gave him an $11,500 Rolex. This has literally been laying in the open for months, and not one single reporter in Washington has noticed that. I check that stuff every single day. Another example, Bob Corker, as he was being vetted to be Donald Trump's nominee, invested $500,000 with Mitt Romney's private equity fund.
No kidding.
Personal money. These are things that are in the open, accessible to every reporter in Washington, and no one does it.
The main thing I want to know is why Bob Corker sounds like Arlo Guthrie. But I hear him do Alice's Restaurant. Anna, we've talked about this before. You've covered The Hill for a long time. I'm a dude. I've never had any problems with sexual harassment. Maybe it's not only just because I'm a guy.
Is it just a new thing?
Yeah, I think that very well. You know, Bresnahan is exactly the same way. He hasn't had any problems with that either. What's it like being a young woman covering an institution which for so long has been so male-dominated on the Republican side? What's the percentage of women? 17%? And in leadership? Maybe a little higher in leadership.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, as a young woman, I covered lobbying, which is even kind of harder to break into because it's all old white men. At least at that time, it really was. But I think it is something that you learn very quickly to have a shield up, that this is, you need to present yourself in a very professional way because otherwise, because of the way that the institutions work, the culture that is pervasive of drinking and staying out late, and that's how sources want it. That's when they're going to be their most helpful sometimes. And how do you kind of balance that with also not putting yourself in a situation where you get this reputation as a woman who, you know, has sex with their sources.
Wow. And that's, I mean, like, we should point out that, and I believe Jake is the only one here. I taught in J school. Jake's the only one who actually graduated from J school. That's a no-no, right? You're not supposed to do that.
Not supposed to do that.
I would just say, you know, but it's not just, it's people that you wouldn't think that you think would be smart enough or, right? But politicians right. often become that untouchable thing of power, right? And they're used to young women being, you know, kind of in awe of them, and you're asking them questions, and it's very easy for them to get a little bit too close and friendly in the speaker's lobby, which is in front of everyone in the middle of the day even. So imagine that you take that out at night. And
well, franking privileges are the world's greatest aphrodisiac.
Wow. But I would say, you know, I talk to a lot of young women reporters here at Politico and otherwise about how you dress, making sure that you're not the person that people think are, you know, going out too late at night.
You know, it's really funny. I had a conversation, it's probably 2 months ago with Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York. And she said that I wear black all the time. She said, and it wasn't necessarily because of like the sex stuff, though. She said that she had some weird interactions with older senators when she was.
And she also wrote about that, didn't she?
Yeah, she wrote about it. She just said that she won't wear that. It cuts down a level of conversation that it focuses stuff. It focuses on the things that she really wants to communicate about. Here's the thing. Now, how long have you been covering Washington now, Anna?
I've been here since 2004.
So you've been here for roughly 12 years. Do you feel, and I want the answer very much to be yes, though I suspect it isn't. Do you think the dynamics changed at all? Do you think it's become less that way?
I think social media, right? When I was in 2004, there wasn't Twitter. There wasn't, you had cell phones, and I think I had my first BlackBerry, but there wasn't camera phones everywhere right. in the same way, in the kind of nature of the TMZ 24-hour Kim Kardashian, you know, news cycle yep. wasn't there. So I think that people in general are more conscious of what they say. I also think one of the things I tell young women reporters all the time is that you're the one who has all the power. And if they don't understand that, I mean, you can wreck their career in a minute.
Wow.
So, you know, you have to come with confidence to your job and you have to take that very seriously. You don't become some crazy power megalomaniac. But, you know, if someone makes a joke that's inappropriate, you think it's okay to say like, hey, man, like not cool.
But really, this is really about the flow and the sex stuff. It is interesting because I'm from New York, and New York's more of a money town, obviously. A money town, a fame town, much less about kind of the flow of power. In a weird way, New York is like sort of like the workplace in New York, and this is a really great generalization. It's less sort of sexualized. I find Washington is a much hornier town than New York in a lot of ways, you know. But talking about kind of the flow of power, Jake, you started off as somebody who was coming up here really straight out of college. How do you kind of get, obviously you were somebody who was really aggressive and everybody noticed that early on. How do you kind of go from zero to somewhere? Like and it seemed like you were able to do that fast. You're very ambitious, but like how do you, what would you recommend to a young reporter to sort of get noticed and get in the game fast? Because part of everything is getting on the radar of the sources.
Probably something that I didn't do early on, which was listen to people and act like I thought I knew everything and I really knew nothing. And right. it took me a year or two to kind of realize that I didn't know anything and that I had people like you and Brez and Manu, although he's not that much older than me, and around, and to listen to them and And I just think you need to become indispensable at something. And you need to be the person who does X really well, whether that's, you know Dodd-Frank like the back of your hand, or you know agriculture policy like the back of your hand. And that's what a lot of our newsroom is. You know, it's the best in almost every subject matter in town.
Well, but don't you think part of it too, I always say, is like 90% of covering Capitol Hill is showing up, right? You were the guy who was always outside the room, always outside the meetings. When
and
everybody,
people just start talking to you.
Because they recognize you. All of a sudden, you know, you become, oh, you're Jake Sherman. We're, you know, oh, we want to tell you the information because you're the one who's putting in as much sweat equity as we are.
Yeah, I think it's as simple as just people appreciate that you're giving them time and you're working hard, you know?
Well, you're also, the other thing that I notice, and I have, again, it's a slightly different approach. I tend to be generally more confrontational than a lot of people. But I think one of the things is you're also elevating them. They're your, what is it? The famous line is that politics is Hollywood for ugly people, right?
Yeah.
But you are elevating people to a level of sort of fame and importance that they normally, you are the instrument of that for those people,
especially in this era, right? Where, for fundraising, for everything that these members do, the minute they're elected, they're running for re-election.
It's what my dad once told me, politics, and it's so true, politics is about getting power, keeping power, and increasing power. And it's actually no more difficult than that.
One last thing is, you know, obviously, I'm not going to kid around here. These are big shoes you guys have to fill. And Mike Allen defined this genre, really. I mean, I guess you go back to sort of Mark Halperin with The Note, but Mikey personalized it in a way that Mark never did, right? Mikey became this sort of, you know, enigmatic person. Everybody at least thought they knew, right, around town. What are you worried about? I mean, this is obviously you're keeping a lot of the stuff in place that was there. There's going to be a lot that's familiar, but you're also going to label this as your own. Well, I mean, what are your sort of concerns as you're headed forward on this?
I mean, second acts are always tough, right? I mean, no, I don't think either of us have designs on trying to be Mikey, or, you know, I don't think any. There's only one Mikey in a generation of kind of reporters. So I think, you know, making sure that people continue to get what they get, you know, change is hard for everyone. And so, you know, we will be a little bit different. But hopefully, I think if we continue to try to be indispensable, and that's by bringing news, you know, essential news. What were you saying about that, Jake? What's your term?
Essential information from essential people, and harnessing the Playbook community, which Mike has built. And we're lucky because there's nothing else in the marketplace. There's nothing else in the space.
I don't think there is. I mean, I think there are people who are out there who are doing good things, but they've really all kind of reverted to the very conventional morning tip sheet kind of thing.
Well, and it's also a lot of punditry. And like, if there's one thing Anna and I are not, it's pundits.
Right.
Like, we're looking to bring people news, what they need to know before their 8 a.m. meeting or before their 8 a.m., you know, before they go on television.
And thoughts from like CEOs and thought leaders and from not just in Washington, but that people in power would find illuminating.
Illuminating and essential. Like, if you want to know the five things Paul Ryan thinks he'll get done before the end of the year, that's going to be in Playbook. That's going to be nowhere else. And it's going to be in Playbook because of the community.
Okay, but one question I have, and this will be the last one. What if that's bullshit? So what if, like, the list that these guys give you, and you know the criticism of tip sheets, and sometimes Playbook in the past, not always, is that you are essentially the press release before the press release comes out, right? That would be the lowest, I mean, sort of the, that would be the least fruitful day where you're sort of just jumping the press release. How do you sort of impose skepticism on what people are giving you?
I think because we have the access to the people, and I think we will impose, we're talking to these people and we'll impose the skepticism in real time because we know the town and we know how it works. So if Paul Ryan says something that's nonsense, we will have the opportunity of saying, wait a minute, but X, Y, and Z, and have him respond to that. And I think that's one way to do it. And there's also, we're expanding Playbook's offerings. There's going to be more room to delve into these things. That's another way we're going to be able to do it. So I think there's a lot of, this is not reinventing the wheel, right? The Playbook is a platform, and it's a platform to do the kind of journalism that Mike has done and the journalism that we have also done.
All right, guys. Well, I'll hold you to that one. thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Glenn. You.